What does one of the world's leading global health experts have to say about how the international community handled the COVID-19 pandemic? How did he go from a close-knit blue-collar community in Milwaukee to representing the United States across more than 100 countries? Ambassador Mark Dybul, former U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, Executive Chair of Platform Life Sciences, and professor in Georgetown University's Department of Medicine, answers these questions and more. I'm your host, Hadil Ali. Welcome to Driving Impact.
Driving Impact, an exclusive insight into the personal backgrounds and careers of trailblazers on the front lines of policy.
Ambassador Dybul, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to CSIS.
Good to be back here.
I know you don't live in DC, so you drove down this morning.
I did, yeah.
Well, thank you for making the trip. And I know you do quite a bit of these speaking engagements, but we don't often get to hear about your story, your background. So thank you for giving us that honor.
I usually don't talk about it, so it's,
Thank you. Thank you for doing that with us on our show. Ambassador, to start off, I want to ask you, what did 10-year-old Mark Dybul want to be when he grew up?
I wanted to be a diplomat and a politician.
Where were those ideas, diplomat, politician, come from? Was that something around you, or where did you?
I have no idea. When you're that old, I don't think you know where your things come from. Yeah. Before that, I wanted to be a priest, so it's pretty wide range. I was very interested in politics and international affairs, effectively, and read a lot about it, starting as early as I could read.
At a very early age. And I know you described yourself coming from a typical blue-collar Milwaukee family. Could you paint that picture for me?
Yeah, my dad was a sheet metal worker. My mom was a housewife. She studied to be a secretary and occasionally would do some side jobs as we got older. But we had five kids in the family, so there wasn't a lot of time for that. I have no idea how anyone does five kids, actually. But, my second generation on both sides, Polish, Italian, very common in Milwaukee, all pretty much factory, blue-collar worker. No one in my parents' age or grandparents' age went past high school, and some didn't even make it to the end of high school.
So you were the first in your family to go to college?
Of my four siblings, three of us went to college, and my older sister did, so she was the first to go to college. I'm the first and only in the entire extent, and this is not just me, this is the extended, our family, but our extended family, which is rather large, is all about the same. I'm the only kid in our family's history to go to a private university, to get an advanced degree. Two of my nieces and nephews have gone to private school, but in the 50 to 100, I was certainly the first to go to private high school.
How do you think that upbringing informed or shaped the career trajectory that you ended up taking?
I think it shaped my values. And what I believe, it was a little more insular. I mean, most of my family doesn't even have passports, so they don't really understand the international part. But it definitely informed my values. And I was brought up in a Christian Catholic environment, hence the priest thing. And we all went to, my parents scraped so we could all go to Catholic high grade schools.
So education was an important
education. Yeah, with all immigrant families, educating the next generation is hugely important.
Yeah. You mentioned the passport piece. I went to an undergrad in Missouri, and a lot of my friends didn't have a passport. And that was surprising to me because I'd grown up in multiple countries, first generation American. I just thought everybody had a passport. Everybody got to travel the world. And I think being exposed to that was very important, understanding some of those disparities that you see across the United States.
Yeah, disparities and also just mindset, very different way of looking at the world. My entire family, literally, of all cousins, aunts, uncles, lived within 2 miles of each other.
And are a lot of them still in the same?
A fair number. Yeah. In my own family, a lot of the siblings have left. But in the extended family, pretty much everyone's still within the same.
In the same area?
3-mile radius.
Yeah. I have to ask you, Ambassador, Did you eat cheese curds growing up? Were those a thing?
Yeah, cheese curds really weren't a thing when I was young. That seems to be more of a thing. Cheese everything, definitely.
Yeah.
Really unhealthy sausages, lard sandwiches, potato chip sandwiches, those kinds of things. But cheese curds weren't quite as common back then, at least that I recall.
I will admit to you that I did not know much about Milwaukee before our interview here today. So I took some time to look up some facts, and Milwaukee is a very interesting place. So I want to ask you some facts about Milwaukee, and you tell me if you knew them, if they're true.
I haven't lived there since I was 16, but I'll do my best.
Okay, let me try to quiz you on a few here. So the art museum in Milwaukee moves. Did you know that?
It does. It has wings. It's a Calatrava. Uh-huh. And actually before that, it was a Sarandon, which was the old war memorial. Milwaukee, like Chicago, has a lot of industrial money, and mm-hmm. arts were very important. The public library was a very important part of my life growing up, the main one downtown. That's when you used to be able to take out classical albums mm-hmm. and pictures and things like that. So the arts have been very important mm-hmm. in Chicago for a long time. I mean, in Milwaukee for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also, the person that invented the typewriter is mm-hmm. from Milwaukee. The person that invented answering machines is also from Milwaukee.
That one I didn't know, yeah.
And the world's largest music festival is also in Milwaukee. I didn't know any of these.
Summerfest, yeah.
The Summerfest.
Which was very small when I was a kid.
So that was very interesting for me to learn more about Milwaukee. Ambassador, you mentioned earlier that you were the first in your family to go to private high school, private college, professional school. Did you always want to study medicine?
No, it was the last thing on my mind.
Yeah.
No. No, I am, as an undergrad, I went to Georgetown University, started in the School of Foreign Service. Yeah. not such a great couple of years, but I was in Pat Ewing's class, so we had a pretty good run.
Yeah.
I started in the School of Foreign Service. I thought I wanted to be a diplomat, then realized I didn't want it at all, switched to the college, studied philosophy, theology, thought I would be a career person in Foreign Service, be an ambassador, go into politics eventually. God has a great sense of humor, so when I switched to the liberal arts, I ended up back at the State Department with an ambassadorial title. So.
So you were considering at a time a PhD in philosophy or theology?
I started in philosophy, then shifted interest to theology, and then to poetry, which I think is actually quite a natural progression. You go from something that's more concrete and effable to something that's ineffable, mm-hmm. which is poetry, and theology is kind of in between.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to decide between the three of those when I was basically the chief of staff to the president of Georgetown University.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd read an article about HIV/AIDS in Africa when I was an undergrad, and I hated science, actually. I took no science classes. I took physics of the energy and the environment and actually what was called audio reproduction.
Mm.
I'm so old that it was about how stereos work. those were my science classes. I hated science because I thought science was the technical piece, not the thought piece.
Yeah.
So that article just grabbed me in a way that I couldn't let go of for some reason. And then I shifted and went on to medical school with no pre-med classes.
Mm.
Interesting. And from there, back then when I was in it and I did my residency on the south side of Chicago, we just watched people with HIV die. I did my fourth year of medical school in San Francisco in the 80s in a very, very rough period. I literally sat with 17-year-olds dying alone because no one would be around them. And so in fact, when I told the head of oncology at the University of Chicago that I wanted to go into HIV, said, why would you want to do something that depressing? So I wanted to go into research, which led me to NIH and studying under Tony Fauci, and everything kind of flowed from there.
Yeah. So that article was that turning point that ignited your interest in medicine.
Yeah. Well, it ignited my interest in HIV.
HIV specifically.
There were two pathways, and I did do advocacy work. I went down, did all the protests and all those things. But really, it was the what could be done to do something for people. There had to be an answer.
Yeah.
That drew me into medicine and science.
Yeah. So that was your actual inspiration behind your passion for this work. Have there assumptions been made about why you were interested in this work?
Yeah, a lot of people assume because I'm gay that I went into it because of the gay pandemic, which was frightening. I mean, I grew up during that. That's not what drew me. I wasn't out when I read the article about Africa. It was it was Africa and the devastation in Africa that really drew me.
The term global health.
Yeah.
I know what it means. I think many of our viewers know what it means. We can think of examples, but that term didn't always exist, right?
Didn't exist when anything started. Yeah. It really started in around 2000-ish. Before that, it was just public health, epidemiology. Mm-hmm. Global health is a very new term and a very new activity. And really, it's things like PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, the Gavi, and really the Millennium Development Goals. And this, of course, is the Sustainable Development Goals.
Mm-hmm.
But it was that began really what was an extraordinary decade of global leadership. From all over, from Africa, from Kofi Annan at the United Nations, and from leaders. It's hard to think of it now, but there were 5-6 global leaders that really focused on what we would call global health now.
Global health, right. You mentioned PEPFAR. In 2006, you were confirmed the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and led PEPFAR for the next 3 years. President Bush care deeply about this project, and you've gone on to describe PEPFAR as the most successful global health program in history. What made it so unique and successful?
Well, first of all, I actually quote Lancet, which was hardly a fan of the Bush administration, that called it that in 2008 while I was coordinator. I mean, I was fortunate to be part of the creation of it. So when President Bush wanted to do something large, big on HIV/AIDS, which he wanted to do, they wanted to do that coming into office. They, of course, turned to Tony Fauci because anyone with a brain would turn to Tony. He and I were doing work together in Africa, we were trying to make antivirals more available in Africa and studying ways to do that. So they basically asked him, he asked me, we worked together with a very small group in the White House. I think there were 8 of us total. That put together what became the plan that the president adopted. But it was the president's vision. It was his idea. Mm-hmm. We were actually thinking smaller. He was the one who said, think big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was privileged to be there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Then after it was announced, I was seconded to the White House and then seconded to the State Department when there were, I think, 9 of us in the basement of the State Department in the transition offices with no money and at that point. So we grew from that within 5 years to $6.5 billion a year and met the goals on time and on budget. There are a couple things that made it a success. One was presidential leadership. You cannot do something this bold, that bold and visionary without real president, and not just announcement. He was involved, he led, he pushed. Without that, we would have gotten nowhere. We wouldn't have gotten out of Congress. We wouldn't have gotten any appropriation. When PEPFAR was announced, we counted and there were 77 presidential initiatives. The president probably knew about 3 of them. So that presidential leadership was absolutely essential. Bipartisanship and intentional bipartisanship,
right.
We never, ever met the majority alone, whether it was Republican or Democrat. And that was hugely important, and that's played out. Partnership, so building the base of support across strange groups where you have faith-based organizations with LGBTQ advocacy organizations with traditional global health people all coming together around something visionary. And then the underlying principles, which really came from the Monterey Consensus, which drove actually a revolution in development, not just global health. And those principles were country ownership first. And that was absolutely essential. Country ownership. We were not in charge of the programming. They were in charge. It was their national plan, their national strategy, their effort. We were supporting, in fact, serving them. President felt very strong about that. Condi felt, I felt very strongly about that. Accountability, results-based. I mean, people forget that before PEPFAR, really when the U.S. government talked about any development program was how much money do you spend? The president was very clear, don't tell me how much money you're going to spend. Come back and tell me what you're going to do, and I'll find the money for it, how you're going to do it. That was what was essential. Good governance. Everyone jumps to anti-corruption, which is true. Corruption is part of that. But the biggest part of that is best use of money. Mm-hmm. How do you effectively and most effectively use money towards that accountability, mm-hmm. towards that country ownership? And then the last piece is that economies drive mm-hmm. development. So you have to put all those pieces together. And those pieces were the lifeblood mm-hmm. of PEPFAR, and that's why it succeeded.
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit more about some of the themes that you brought up, and especially intentional bipartisanship here in a second. But before I do that, Ambassador, when you became the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, you broke some firsts for the LGBTQIA+ community as the first openly gay ambassador with the rank of Assistant Secretary of State. Can you tell me a little bit more about that swearing-in ceremony? Who was there?
Yeah.
Paint that picture.
Yeah, I mean, this is very, I didn't want to do it. But the State Department, particularly Dina Powell, who was the head of communications at the time, thought it was important to highlight PEPFAR. And so the entire thing was not, it was not about me. It was about PEPFAR. Everyone's speech was about PEPFAR. It wasn't about me. And because it was important, the president actually considered coming, but his schedule was busy. So Mrs. Bush represented him. She was very supportive of PEPFAR, the president's malaria initiative, deeply engaged. And Condi, of course, the Secretary of State, presided. And during the introduction, Condi referred to my partner at the time, because we couldn't get married, now husband's mother, as my mother-in-law, which no one seemed to think was a problem, including her staff and the White House and everyone else who read it and cleared it. There, no one had a problem for a couple of days. And then Frank Rich in the New York Times, so it came from the left, not from the right,
right.
Wrote an article blasting the administration for hypocrisy. This was October of 2006, which was an election, midterm election cycle, and a month before, so clearly for political reasons. And it was actually that side, the left side, that was attacking, not the right. So then the right responded, ended up on the front page of a bunch of newspapers around the world, friends from Turkey and Italy called me, do you know you're on the front page of the paper? And then something extraordinary happened. It came up in the with Tony, who was the press secretary at the time. It came up in the press room at the White House. And he said, the secretary said what she said, out of due respect for the people involved. And that's the end of it. Right. And that was the end of it.
Right. Do you feel like we've made some progress in that area since then?
We've definitely made progress. I mean, there are many openly gay appointees at the same level, maybe even some higher at this point. Assistant Secretary of State level is pretty high in the bureaucracy because the State Department is the top ranking of the department. So we made a huge amount of progress, not just on that, but in gay in LGBTQ rights in general. There have certainly been setbacks, and we're experiencing some of those around the world. I mean, it's not just in this country, but in Africa, absolutely. You know, every head of state knew I was gay. Kendrick Warren, I'm the leaders of churches knew I, you know, this was not a secret. It was open. So, and there was never an issue, astoundingly enough.
Mm-hmm. Certainly setbacks, you're saying globally, Uganda, an example. I want to talk a little bit more about how U.S. global health policies impact our image abroad. One of my favorite stories that I've heard you speak about is a visit that you took to Ethiopia, and you were meeting with a director of a clinic in a small town, and you asked him, you know, what does PEPFAR mean to you? And his answer was that the American people care about us. Can you talk a little bit more about how this work impacts how the U.S. is perceived globally?
Yeah, and I actually just talked with John Kengasong, the current Global AIDS coordinator, just got back from Africa, and he told me the exact same stories. Wow. And he was in Namibia. Mm-hmm. I had the very same experience in Namibia. Namibia is a country that hated the United States because during apartheid and their fight for independence, we did not support the independence movement, which is tragic. So they hated it. They literally hated the United States. And the first time I went, they were like, we really hate you. You did terrible things to us. Mm-hmm. But you are the only country supporting us in this fight against HIV. Mm-hmm. And it changed everything. And they still talk about, John had the same conversation with the president, with the president of the country. Mm-hmm. That's an example of the radical change, but it's actually documented. So Senators Frist and Daschle, who were majority and minority leader, respectively, of the Senate when the bill was passed, with the Bipartisan Policy Council, the Bipartisan Something Council, did a study looking at Gallup polls and actually showed a 20% increase in favorability in countries where PEPFAR is very strong. So it's very clear. And if you go to a village, it's very clear. I mean, people know that the American people like this village leader, that the American people are standing with them and stepped in when they were all dying, literally all dying. They had no hope, no hope at all. And that hope was restored. And that is more diplomacy than virtually anything. And it goes down, it's from head of state down to village level. It's extraordinary.
And you shared some of that data in a recent House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing. You said in PEPFAR-supported countries, 68% of respondents have a positive view about the U.S. compared to 40% in non-PEPFAR-supported countries. So that exactly.
Yeah. And it's worth noting that 68% is higher than the favorability rating of the American people about the United States.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about travel. I know you've done quite a bit of travel. As of 2019, you've traveled to 110 countries. I'm sure it's more now. Do you know the number?
Yeah, I don't. So it's definitely more. It's not a lot more because of COVID and because I keep having to go back to the same place. But yeah, the Global Fund actually is, I did a lot of additional travel. PEPFAR was 15 countries. I really concentrated there, had to go to others for meetings and things, but it was really the Global Fund where I expanded the number quite a bit, both for personal and professional travel. But it's been a great privilege to visit that many countries.
What have you enjoyed the most about traveling?
The most important thing is meeting people. I actually had a rule when I was at PEPFAR, which was more difficult at the Global Fund, given the number of countries. I had the luxury of being able to go for a week or two, even as coordinator. And the rule was one day in the capital to do the diplomatic stuff that was necessary. The rest was out. You had to go out and meet people. And really sitting with people in their homes and villages and talking with them. Having kids run away because I was the first white person they'd ever seen. I thought I was a ghost. Pretty extraordinary experience.
Yeah.
But meeting with people all over the world and seeing what they care about and seeing who they are. Connecting the human family is one of the greatest privileges anyone could ever have.
Yeah, absolutely. Ambassador, you brought a memento to share with us here today. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you brought?
Yeah, so it's a globe, which was given to me by, I actually collect globes, but it was given to me when I was confirmed as the U.S. Global AIDS coordinator by a dear friend. And it's very meaningful to me as a reminder. I keep it on my desk for a couple of reasons. I've always been interested, as I mentioned, in international affairs. I started in the School of Foreign Service. I was studying China. Then I became very interested in Africa, but just cultures and history. I love history. But I think what I learned as I was growing into PEPFAR and actually a little bit before at NIH is how important a global mindset is, that everything we think of, every problem, every solution, every action, every decision should be considered in a global context. I run two massive global organizations. I can count on a couple of hands the number of people who have a global mindset. The new generation, I think, is a little bit different, but no matter, even when you're in global organizations, people think very locally, their own local, not globally. And if we all thought more about how do our actions, decisions connect us to the world? How do they impact the world positively? And what are we doing that could negatively affect the world? And that includes the planet. We would probably have a much better world. So it's a constant reminder. And it's not always easy to, in any decision and any thought, to always have a global mindset.
And COVID-19 pandemic was an excellent example
of a failure to do that.
That's
a total failure to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ambassador, you mentioned bipartisanship, intentional bipartisanship, which has been key to a lot of the work that you've done. What are some of the key skills that you say have been the most important to be able to engage in a bipartisan way on these issues?
One is intentionality. It's very easy when someone's in the majority to talk to the majority because they control. You always have to talk to the minority too. First of all, they're important because they're people and they have thoughts and they're really smart. I mean, the people on the Hill, especially the staff, are extraordinarily smart, but they're eventually going to be in the majority. I mean, it's just it's silly not to engage. And I was actually told this when the Democrats took over the majority. They were like, look, you were the only one, literally the only one talking to us. Mm. So come see us whenever you need to. We always did bipartisan. So it has to be intentional. The second piece is to actually listen. You don't do it just to check a box, but to actually listen. The ideas are, they have ideas too. I mean, a lot of the people on the Hill have been doing this longer than anyone in the administration. They have very good ideas, and they have very good thoughts on what should be done, especially from a legislative perspective, but also from an in-country perspective. They go visit as well. And thirdly, politics and parties should not separate us. It's just a, and often we had as many Democrats, I served in a Republican administration, we had as many more Democrats likely to support us. In fact, in the first signing ceremony, one of the person from the White House, there were 700 people in the room, some very senior person in the White House looked at me and was like, we don't have seven votes in this room. Which I think was a great statement about, let's do something that's globally important, not for politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure throughout so much of your travel, you've met some incredible people. I want to ask you a little bit more about Sir Elton John. I think you've interacted with and you've met. What have been some of the settings? I think one I saw was in 2015 here in D.C. I think there was a lunch with Randy Barry. But I'm sure you've met him on other occasions as well. Can you share a little bit more?
Well, I think the 2015 one was actually around a Senate hearing when Lindsey Graham was ranking and Leahy was ranking. I mean, when Lindsey was chair and Leahy was ranking, and the witnesses were Elton, Rick Warren, myself, and Deb Burks, who was coordinator at the time. So it was around that event. But I'm also on I'm on the board of the Elton John AIDS Foundation, so we have a fair number of interactions. He's an extraordinary, extraordinary man, as is his husband, David Furnish, and the foundation does exceptional work. The CEO, Anne Aslett, is amazing. They're here pretty regularly. President Biden gave him an award, and he sang on the White House lawn. He really is an exceptional man and cares deeply about people, has that global perspective. And always says, which I think is right, lead with love. You know, love is the answer. But it's been a great privilege to get to know him and serve his foundation and his vision.
And I'm sure having his support and the support of his foundation is very important in moving these issues forward.
Can be, and not just in the United States.
Yeah, globally.
Globally, I mean, in the UK.
Yeah.
But there's almost no one who won't take a meeting with him. But yeah, the difference is there are a lot of people who are famous who can, anyone will take a meeting with them, but they just want a picture. You have to know what you're doing and talking about and listen and care. And Elton does that, Bono does that, some others do it extremely well. Charlize Theron does that extremely well.
You mentioned, Ambassador, that global problems require global responses. And we've seen that through the HIV pandemic, COVID-19, the importance of collaborating with a wide range of stakeholders. Following the COVID-19 pandemic, where do you think our global health system stands today?
In chatters. I would say I say this regularly and get in trouble for it. I think we're in worse position now than we were 2.5 years ago. Parts of the world came together during the beginning of the response, but that was mostly around research. That has now gone back to, everyone's gone back to their corners. I think COVID-19 and the global response. There was no global response. There was a nationalistic response. And if you compare that to HIV, HIV was an example of a global response, hugely successful. COVID is an example of an utter failure of a global response and an utter failure in what we're doing. And we're still at risk. I mean, people aren't paying attention to the fact that hospitalizations and infections are higher than in the United States, are higher than at any point in this pandemic today. Deaths are down, but the hospitalization rate is as high as it's ever been. So this is just going to keep happening. But we still are not connected and collected on where we need to go. And that's a failure of global leadership.
Yeah. Are there potentially any positives to take away? Any positive lessons that we can learn?
The positive lessons are what not to do.
No.
And I was on the independent panel for pandemic preparedness and response, and we put out a number of recommendations. I'm still deeply engaged. If you look at what we talked about as the success of PEPFAR, President, head of state leadership, You absolutely have to have that. Mm-hmm. We need a head of state leadership council for pandemics because mm-hmm. we're going to keep having them. If you don't have heads of state, mm-hmm. you don't have multi-sectoral.
Right.
And that was important in the mm-hmm. PEPFAR. We had the Department of Defense, mm-hmm. the Department of Labor initially, USAID, Health and Human Services in every aspect. Same globally. You have to, the private sector has to absolutely be at the table. The community organizations, faith-based, you have to pull everyone mm-hmm. together. The research and development community is fundamentally failing us in terms of development and access. Mm-hmm. The way we do clinical trials is absurd. Mm-hmm. But we can fix all of this, but we have to have global leadership, and we're not there. We mm-hmm. don't have, if you look at the things that have gone extremely well, and I don't just mean in global health, so the saving of the global economy in 2008. I mean, Gordon Brown led Europe. Paulson, under President Bush, led the United States, and they worked closely together and basically saved the world's economy. That's how you work together. PEPFAR, the Global Fund, Gavi, the Millennium Development Goals, at least on the global health side, the response to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. When we have global connected responses, things work.
Right.
Some examples of things that are total failures, COVID-19, one of them. We failed to act as a global community. We got nationalistic. So the lessons are very clear.
Yeah.
That pathway out of that, specifically on COVID-19, is relatively clear to me. But we have the same problem with biosecurity. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should be doing the same thing on biosecurity now. The UK announced a summit. The Biden administration is doing some good work. So we have leadership there. We might actually be able to replicate what we did in PEPFAR and biosecurity. But we're a long way away.
Long way to go.
Long way to go.
You're a full tenured professor at Georgetown. You quite often engage with students, young professionals. What are some of the lessons that you're passing down to them to try to carry some of these lessons forward?
Well, when I do guest lecture, and I do guest lecture because I travel too much and it's too difficult to do a full course. And guest lecturing is great. It's like being an uncle, which I am. You get all the advantages and fun without all the mess.
You can leave when you need to.
No grading, no argument over, no writing a paper, no. It's a lot easier. So it's many things we talked about, global mindset, you know, the history of some of these global health and development activities, why they've succeeded and failed. That we also talk about the future. And I really, my biggest point to them is you're going to have to lead. And you can do it in ways that we couldn't. Clearly, we're not going to fix the global problems. My generation, we provided a lot of messes to clean up. But no matter what you're doing, no matter what sector you're in, you can help and lead if you have a global mindset.
Global mindset, right. So what's the future of global health? This relatively new field, where do you see it going?
Well, we'll see if it's even around. I mean, there isn't a lot of interest in it. There are, you know, the G7 had pandemics again, the G20, but it's more sideshows. People are now focused on other issues, which I understand.
It's not the hot topic anymore.
But I think that's a mistake. I mean, and this is our problem. We keep seeing things in silos, even the SDGs, even though the chapeau of the Sustainable Development Goals talks about putting everything together, but then shreds everything apart, which is our tendency. Climate and health are linked at the hip. I mean, they're intertwined. The systemic reasons for each are similar, and we should be innovating across those areas. You put food security in, and that triad, you know, that those three basically go together. Yeah. All of development functionally goes together, but we keep trying to separate pieces of development. So if global health is going to go anywhere, it has to go along with others. It has to be part of a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. Same for any of those other individual areas, because they'll wax and wane. Mm-hmm. Climate was the big issue now. Now security is a big
right.
So things come in and out, and we do a terrible job in the United States because we're so separated and we don't bring things together.
Yeah.
The private sector has to be involved. I mean, you can't develop countries that are trying to develop their economies greater and they can leapfrog. Mm-hmm. They need the private sector in there as much or more than the government support. And we're not very good at bringing those pieces together.
I took away so much from the conversation, but the three things that are top of mind is the importance of leadership. You said intentional bipartisanship and the global mindset. Before we wrap up our conversations here, we like to ask our guests three questions every episode of Driving Impact Rapid Fire. Are you ready?
Sure.
Sounds good. What are three words you would use to describe your career?
Humbling, surprising, and abundant.
In your opinion, what does it mean to be American?
At our best, it means believing in the dignity and worth of every human life. And from that comes equality, because if you believe in the dignity and worth of every human life, comes equality. And generosity, compassion, and a classic American word, nice. There's a lot. Kindness and niceness is a huge thing. And when we're at our best, those all come together. And I think PEPFAR and the Global Fund, where we're the largest contributor and other things, are a great example of where we're at our best. COVID-19 was an example of where we were very far from our best.
And what is giving you some hope right now?
Young people.
Yeah.
Young people don't see color. They don't see sexuality. They don't see the difference between climate change and health and feeding oneself. There's a vision and an openness and a hope. And I should have said that about what it means to be American. It means to be optimistic and hopeful. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've always been known for. We've retracted from that. We need to get back to that. Mm-hmm. And when you meet young people, not just all over the world, that commonality of hope, optimism, the future, that's what keeps me hopeful.
That's what also gives me hope. The young people, the values that they bring, the energy. Ambassador Dybul, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such an honor to learn more about your sport story, especially that you don't typically share a lot about your background. So thank you for taking the time to do that with us.
Thanks for inviting me. Enjoyed being with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being part of our conversation with Ambassador Mark Dybul on his journey to leading one of the most successful global health programs in history and his vision for the future of the field. Do you want to hear more exclusive stories from policy leaders? Be sure to follow Driving Impact on YouTube, Spotify, or CSIS.org.